broadcast for shooters, hunters, and gun enthusiasts. This is the Firearms Radio Network. The bandwidth for this edition of the Off-Road Podcast is brought to you by the Firearms Radio Network. Firearmsradio.tv.
Off-Road Podcast, Episode 202, Coyote Enterprises, Part 1. Welcome to the Off-Road Podcast. Today we'll exploring the off-road world, whether you like crawling up rock ledges or enjoy exploring the back roads with your family. Stay with us to find out events in your area, off-road news, or topics of interest to every guy and girl who craves the outdoors as seen through the windshield. I'm your host, Ben, and tonight I'm here with my co-hosts, Steve, Jeremy, and Aaron. Normally I'd ask everyone how they're doing, but we're on holiday break and didn't want to leave you out in the wind with a no episodes. So here's the first part of our interview with Coyote Enterprises.
Help support the show and use our affiliate links for Amazon and Gaia GPS. They cost you nothing but a little extra time to click through the link, and in the case of Gaia GPS, they can save you up to 40%. Also, buy an off-road podcast sticker by sending $5 to offroadpodcast@gmail.com through PayPal.
All right, patriotpatch.co. Go check out their selection of great patches and shirts. Join the Patch of the Month Club for $15 a month and receive a patch and matching sticker every month. Also, check out their new World War II patches. They got a B-17 bomber, a Willie's Jeep, and a Sherman tank.
Go prepared with Warren Industries. They introduced the first recreational winch in 1959 and lead the industry with their dedication to quality and reliability. When you dig yourself in deep, make sure you have the right tools to get yourself out. Get Warren equipped and go where others can't. Now, let's get ready for adventure and head into our main topic.
All right. Well, tonight we have our guest, Harry, who is named the Professor of Off-Roading. He is also the owner of Coyote Enterprises. And we're going to start it off here, Harry, with how do you first get started off-roading, man?
That's actually quite an exciting story and runs chills up my spine to even think about the start of it. It starts out like I'm ancient. I'm 79 years old right now. 1950 or thereabouts. I can't sort out the exact year. Going out in the desert with a couple of World War II Pacific Campaign CB Navy retirees to survey and find out where some property is. We're going to homestead. And so it was strictly two-wheel drive, hacking and thrashing our way out to find where we started surveying and then surveyed it. It's pretty exciting for a 12-year-old to be going out with three guys, two of which are packing sidearms in a canteen and, you know, wearing what looks like military outfits in the Pacific. And that led to my interest in the desert and then also my continuing interest in just plain going on dirt roads, which seemed pretty exciting. About 1955, when I was in high school, I had a friend, Dick Yoder, whose dad owned aircraft sales and brokerage at the Long Beach Airport. The trailer queen that pulled the airplane, or not the trailer queen, the tow queen that pulled the airplanes in and out of the airport was a World War II Jeep. And what we would do is at night we would sneak through the military entrance to the Long Beach Airport, sneak into his dad's hangar, get the Jeep and take it out and head for Signal Hill. Signal Hill was a lover's lane, if you will, only it was a pretty good-sized hill just to the south of the Long Beach Airport. Still is, only it's civilized now. And we'd go around and harass the lovers. You know, we could drive up and flick our lights and drive by them, honk our horn, and then they'd get mad. They'd chase us, which we would encourage, and then they'd be on paved roads, and then we'd just whammo, turn off on a dirt road and evade them and laugh about it and go for number two. So that's how I got started.
That's awesome.
Sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, fun. Yeah. And then, actually, we started taking the Jeep out in the desert. And one of those World War II vets was going to retire out there that we'd gone out with to start with to survey it when we had the properties organized. And he had lots of military stuff. It's a long story, but he was a commander in the Navy, and he retired. And he had more stuff shipped back from Guam, which was where his last service was, as personal property than you can imagine. So like trailers and tires and generators. And so we'd go out wheeling in the desert. This is the Phelan area of the high desert. It's more or less, call it 50 miles from where the King of the Hammers, the Johnson Valley, is now. And we'd go out and abuse that poor Jeep that belonged in the hangars and get flats. One time, actually, we had 7 flats, but between everything that Conley had and what we could fix, we ended up still rolling on having 7 flats in one day. And then we'd take it back, and the mechanic that maintained the thing at the airport, he'd just kind of cock his head and look at both of us, and he says, you know, really interesting how this thing gets weeds in the carburetor by staying in the hangar. So anyway, I'm proud and an exciting way to get started in four-wheel drive, and obviously very addictive to somebody that starts at 12 years old and, you know, ends up enhancing it at what was I, 15. It was even before I could drive, with Dick having the driver's license and getting the daddy's Jeep out in the desert.
So what was your actual first vehicle?
My first vehicle was out in the desert, and it was a 1931 Model A Ford that my dad had taken out there. My dad used to restore Fords, and I'd been wrenching since 7 years old. So it was a Model A Ford, and it had a locker. And let me tell you about that locker, because lockers didn't exist then. Well, I take that back. They did. The Germans had them in World War II. But the way I made a locker was I took the differential apart, welded the spiders together, which made a spool out of the rear axle, and that got me along 150-500% better than the open differential in that Model A. So that was my first vehicle.
Was that the first Lincoln locker?
I don't know what a Lincoln locker is. It's just
Lincoln welder.
Oh yeah, Lincoln welder. Yes, that's what it would be called. Yes, yes. Hadn't heard it called that. Yep, for sure. In fact, I'm trying to remember now. I don't remember welding it up. I don't remember knowing how to weld. Conley probably welded it up, the guy that retired out there, the Navy guy that retired out there. And he probably knew about it and did it for me.
So what was your first off-road vehicle?
My first off-road vehicle was a 1970 Toyota four-wheel drive pickup. When they came over, when Toyota first introduced the four-wheel drive pickup truck.
And it's probably still on the road today.
Bragging rights. I sold it at 105,000 miles to a guy that wanted me to run a compression check on it, or his mechanic to run a compression check on it. And he ran a compression check, and it was like 105, 110, 18, 108, 15 or something like that. And the mechanic says, I can't believe there's 50,000 miles on this vehicle. But it did quite well.
Nice. So being at your age, are you still out in the desert or hitting the trails with a rig?
Not a whole lot. I've got what I called in my classes, and what my classes were primarily for, a Yupmobile. I've got a full-size Toyota Land Cruiser 2000 with air conditioning and stereo and, you know, electric windows and all the cushy stuff. And so I'll still go out and camp out of it and camp in it. And, you know, hit the dirt roads as much as I can. But between wheelbase and lack of large tires and suspension, it's like I spend as much time scraping the underneath as the tires do on the dirt, you know, getting me around.
So tell us about your off-road training videos. Are they still available?
I don't have that many videos. Actually, the guy that made the most videos and I worked with on several different things was, oh my God, I'm just drawing a blank. Rick Russell. And he made the sidekick maps and the off-road videos. And I know his are still available, and I've participated in a couple of those.
I have one of those.
Yeah. Yeah, he was kind of the father of starting all of the off-road videos and had a pretty good market going until off-roading just started growing to where it's at now, and lots of people moved in. And then he had some medical problems that caused him to stop.
I'm sure the internet didn't help with that either.
Yeah, a lot of YouTube, I'm sure, makes for more exciting, shots than something that where you're showing somebody where to go or how to drive.
So in your resume, and also when you've talked to me, you mentioned college classes that you taught about off-roading. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I used to belong to a club called Our Club, O-U-R, Our Ultimate Recreation. It was a self-powered club. It was, backpacking and canoeing and cross-country snowshoeing and skis and bicycling and things like that. And one of the gals was conducting a desert appreciation class at a local college, community college. And that just went click in my mind. And I thought, God, if she can do that, she didn't even have a degree or anything else. She just, she worked at the college, so that probably helped a whole bunch. But when I came out of college, graduated in engineering, I took a job that was less than technical, a corporate kind of job, and I felt that I was going to lose my technical stuff. So I started, applied to be a professor at the college I had attended and teach circuit analysis. And so I had some academic background. I'd taken a UCLA extension course that made me certified to the state of California to be able to teach classes and all that. And so I thought, boy, if she can do that, I ought to be able to offer some four-wheel drive classes. I wonder if anybody would take one. So I approached one college, and they kind of said, not only yes, but hell yes. Sounds kind of interesting and fun. And so I offered one class, and it just was overwhelmed with people that wanted to do it. So I proceeded to increase the number of schools and classes that I was operating at, and it eventually evolved into 31 different colleges from clear down at the Mexican border in Imperial County to clear up into Santa Barbara, Ventura County, Santa Barbara County area. And that ended up too much energy. 31 colleges spread over that distance. I was on the road and playing school teacher at the same time. And I had just more or less retired from an engineering consulting company that I had organized. So that left the time, but it didn't, it wasn't doing me any good money wise. It was okay. I got exposure, but, that evolved into publishing the newsletter and then doing product evaluation and then getting all the connections with the Fords and the Nissans and the Amigos and other cars.
I'm sure that spread just a bit thin.
Yeah. So your bio mentions that you did a year of road racing in 78. What races did you compete in, and what kind of cars were you driving?
Yeah, I... my cousin ended up with some money one year, and I'm in Orange County again, and he somehow or other learned about the ghetto cars, what it was, and there was a series of off-road shops in Fullerton, California, and they called all of them. They called it the ghetto. You could go get, you know, differentials, suspension, body frame, whatever you wanted done. And they built a car, and he bought the car that the ghetto group had built, and that was basically a Class 2 Corvair powered converted VW suspension. It had the trailing arm front VW suspension and the same rear suspension and transaxle that a VW would have, and then it was powered by a Corvair. And so we did Baja and Parker, and I don't think it was called the Barstow to Vegas, but one other race at that time. Didn't do any good, but I was primarily co-driver. He had spent the money. He wanted the thrill of driving, so we...
Yeah, I've been to a few of those races.
Yeah, they have a certain degree of notoriety, the Baja particularly.
Yeah. Well, we used to go out to the Parker. I've been to the Mint when it was the original Mint, a few of the others.
Mm-hmm.
So in your bio, it also mentions your hand in being one of the founders of Tread Lightly. Do you want to kind of explain how that came about?
Yeah, I am not sure. I don't remember how I got acquainted with Cliff Blake. He was the original founder of Tread Lightly. I think it had to do with him being the local, like, chief ranger for part of the San Bernardino Mountain U.S. Forest Service district ranger. And then he talked about starting this organization that was going to try to bring multi-responsible use of backcountry into a group of people that would, you know, preach the good responsible use. And so he asked me and a couple other people to join him to found it, and we founded it. And I participated a while in it, and then he got aced out. Boy, this is probably stuff that some folks maybe don't know or don't want to hear or don't want to know that's being made public, but he got aced out of what he was doing, and it became very commercial, or more commercial than he wanted to participate in. So he backed out of it. And about that time I backed out of it, but it was fun. I was the lead and safety director for the Tread Lightly safety video that was produced. Boy, I don't remember the year, but some time back. And then other, like, profiles and templates for how to conduct classes and things like that.
So what has been your favorite thing to do while off-road?
I preach in my classes. I would teach that there's two aspects to using a four-wheel drive vehicle. One, it's a means to an end, and the other, it's the end itself. The end itself is like racing and the hammers and that kind of stuff. And yes, I participate in it, and yes, I still go to the events. And personally, I look at it as a means to an end, whether to be to get to a place to take pictures or explore a ghost town that I've heard about, or see if I can find a way from point A to point B, like in Mexico, like the Copper Canyon trip. There wasn't supposed to be any way to drive through Copper Canyon. And usually I need a straight guy, but I'll ask, have you ever heard of Copper Canyon? Either one of you ever heard of Copper Canyon?
I haven't.
Okay, good straight guys. And that's not a bad answer. That's the right answer. I call it the world's best kept secret. It is a complex of six canyons that are deeper than the Grand Canyon. And I think that's a pretty well kept secret. And there was a guy named Walt Wheelock. If you were to go into rock hounding stores years past, they would all carry what everybody said, oh, those Jeep books. Walt Wheelock was a retired detective from the Glendale Police Department, and he was a four-wheeler. And he just did lots of exploring and writing small books. I mean, staple-bound, they'd be 50 pages, they'd be 32 pages, and they'd tell you about places to go and so on. Anyway, he said he was going to go down to Copper Canyon to look at it again. And so I asked if I could join him. We went down to Copper Canyon. If you were to picture a map of Mexico and more or less put your finger kind of like right in the middle, if you know the geography, it's just a little west of Guadalajara. Put your finger right in the middle. That's about where Copper Canyon is. So we drove in there, and I got a look at it and asked around about driving through. And they said there's no way, and I said, nobody knew of a way. There's always a way Mexican road-wise. But anyway, long story short, I was going to go through. He decided they'd be piping water and food to my corpse sometime later in the month because I'd gotten lost and died. And anyway, long story short, I made it through. I started running tours through there. And So the more mild kind of exploring adventure things like that are what I like to do off road.
So I just felt the urge. I had to Google it, and that's pretty awesome map wise on how big it is. It looks like a fun trip.
Yeah, it's actually a national park, a federal national park, and they have logging in it. And maybe you've heard of people that used to go on a train ride, a train tour, where they would load their RVs on flatbed cars on the railroad, and then they would tour this canyon down in Mexico. They were doing, they meaning the Mexican tourist industry, were doing that for a long time, and then it got cut off. That country is dope country. And you don't, what most people don't know is we put Mexico in the dope business. Second World War we got involved in it. We needed morphine. Guess where morphine came from prior to getting involved with the Second World War? It came from Asia. All of a sudden we had no source for morphine. And so the government approached the Mexican government and said, will you grow this opium poppy for me? And that's can't think of the name of it, the anesthetic narcotic that is used to cut pain out. Anyway, and the Mexican government says yes, and there's a pretty good size industry got started right in that Copper Canyon area. And come the end of the war of the World War II, guess what? That market goes to zero, or probably close to zero immediately. Well, that's something that's a little hard to fathom for any government. And so the illegal guys started taking over. So anyway, that canyon has a certain degree of badness to it, and or a bad aspect, a criminal aspect to it. And I knew it going in. I figured I could talk my way out of things, just play dumb or whatever, which I did a couple of times, knowing I was dealing with narcotics dealers or growers. And anyway, the train got robbed. Bad things happened on the train, so that tour went away. But the train stayed, and the train has a history unto itself. It was like the U.S. government had gotten a U.S. company had gotten a contract to build a train from, or build a track from, I don't remember the start, but the U.S. someplace clear down south and out to the Pacific coast, kind of at the foot of the Sea of Cortez. And they worked and worked and worked on it. Nasty canyons. I mean, six Grand Canyon-sized canyons. And they never completed it. And so they backed out. And the Mexicans came in and completed it in 1 year.
While you were talking about all this, I was texting my dad because my dad used to off-road race a lot out there in the mm-hmm. Southwest. And I asked him, I says, do you know where Copper Canyon is? And he says, yeah, it's on the mainland side of the Gulf of California. I was like, oh, have you ever been there? He says, no. He says, that's quite a wasteland. Baja Grand Canyon is what he texted back.
Yeah. Yeah, it is and it isn't. What it amounts to is the Grand Canyon is young compared to the Barranca del Cobre, Copper Canyon area. And the way you can immediately tell is Grand Canyon's a wasteland. I mean, picture it, when your picture in your mind is red and dirt and rocks.
Right.
These canyons are green. So they've been around for a couple million years longer than the Grand Canyon. So it's a lot greener, a lot more lush. The Tarahumaran Indians, there's a history there. The Tarahumaran Indians lived there. And so the story goes, the Spanish were trying to conquer Mexico. They got to the Tarahumaran Indians and they spent like, I don't remember the exact number, but years, but I don't remember 30 or 50 years trying to conquer the Tarahumarans, and they couldn't do it because these Indians just knew their way around that canyon, and it's damn hard to fight a complex of six Grand Canyons. So the Spanish gave up on it. And so there's just lots of history there. It was fun to do. I've been thinking about putting together a celebrity trip through it one more time. The last time I went through it was 2010. Yeah, 2010. I used to run two trips a year, and I had to gauge and pace my trips around the rains because we had to cross rivers and cross not Grand Canyon type rivers, but pretty significant rivers to where the one at Chinipas was the big pacing factor. It would be 200 yards wide and it would go to 10 feet deep. You don't drive that. I don't care what you're driving. So I would have to gauge my trips around the rains so I could avoid the rains and the deep water. And there were canyons we traveled in that we would be traveling over log bridges that literally got washed out every season. Sometimes I'd get to a bridge and I'd see a new one, and sometimes I'd get to a bridge and it wasn't a bridge. It was a down in the creek and up on the side and back on the road again. So, yeah, it's desolate in a different way.
So oh my goodness, you are the professor of off-road. Can you share some embarrassing moments on the trail with us?
Yeah, the most embarrassing one. I preach there is always a way to cure everything. And I was leading a Copper Canyon trip, and we went down to Urique from Cerro Cowie, and went down and started back up. And it was a 10% grade, which is a pretty long haul, long, steep grade. Yes, it was a graded road, but it was long. It was, I don't know, 5-6 miles. And about halfway up, I lose my transmission. Actually, I get an announcement. Well, the transmission's slipping and acting funny, and simultaneously the number two car behind me says, Harry, you got a fire underneath. So I got the fire put out. We got it all handled. Got a rope hooked up to it. We towed it into a gringo friend of mine has a hotel there. He's actually more Mexican. He spent more time in Mexico than he has the U.S., and that's fact. But anyway, I got it to his hotel where we were going to stay anyway, and I arranged to ride out. And then I came back with a friend's car, and I was going to tow it out, a friend's 4x, and I had to drill 4 holes in my bumper to hook a tow bar up to it. And this is Mexican Tuleville. And so I have a battery-powered portable drill. And guess what? I didn't get 4 holes drilled with the batteries I had. And so I spent an extra 2 days of going. And these side trips are kind of fun, so shut me off if I'm making too many side trips. But anyway, in a portion of that Cerro Cahuí, there was a guy 5 miles away that actually had been the president of the Chicago, I don't remember whether it was Teamsters or some other union in the U.S. And he'd retired, and he retired down there because he had come from down there. And he had everything in the way of equipment. So Doug drove me over to his house. I don't remember his name. We asked, can we get a generator and a drill from you? And they said, yeah, but whatever his name was, isn't home today. So I had to wait like 2 days. So now all that comes together. Yep, we got the holes drilled. Yep, we got the tow bar fixed up. Yep, I got my Explorer back to the United States. And my portable drill, remember, there's always a way. I just wasn't creative enough to think of this. My portable drill at that time was a 12-volt drill. What do you have an abundance of 12-volt DC in a car? The damn car battery. So, boy, was I embarrassed about that.
It's only an extra 2 days or three, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I was looking into having it put on the train and hauled out to Alamos, not Los Alamos, but Alamos next to Hermosillo on the coast. And then, well, actually, I would have had it towed clear back across the border into the U.S. and then offloaded it and towed it back to California. But that's the most embarrassing one, you know, for a guy that just always knows there's always a way. And I pat myself on the back for being the genius that always comes up with the way. I lost on that one.
Steve?
Oh, I was muted. What is your favorite part about teaching four-wheel drive safety?
The safety part is to the favorite part is kind of it's people oriented. It's to watch the people grow. It's to watch how they improve in their capabilities. I watch people that I've taken on their first trip, and I see them eventually start clubs. I took a CHP commander, the commander for the CHP station in El Centro, and he went on a trip with me. I was lecturing at a college down there, and he went on a trip. And we were in the Anzabrego Desert, and we went down 2 hills, Heart Attack Hill, and then the Devil's Slide. I'm forgetting the name of it right now. Devil's Slide, I think they called it. And when we got out, he says, thanks for giving me the hill, Harry. Thanks for giving me the hill. You know, it was kind of a drive-it for most four-wheel drive people, but for somebody that hadn't four-wheeled for a long time or much before, it was an exciting adventure. And you get to teach on the spot. I required CB radios for all the vehicles for inter-vehicle communication, while underway, and then also lecturing, and then also for instruction purposes. And this Devil's Slide, it was a sandy hill that had off camber to the left and down a cliff. And I would lecture every single person. I said, let's check your radio. I had a small handheld radio. Let's check your radio. Radio's working. Everybody got their seatbelts on. Yep, everybody's got their seatbelts on. And then I would remind them, I'd say, remember, this is left. And I would pat the driver's side of the car. This is left. And then they'd start down the hill. They'd start sliding down the hill to the left. They would be going down the hill, but it's off camber enough. They're going to the left a little bit. And the last thing you do is turn uphill. You're going to roll the car because it was down. It was steep enough down. And I would have to tell them, nope, don't fight left. Go with it. Just drift left a little bit. And so that was kind of exciting to see people follow the instructions and be successful with it. Not everybody was always successful. I've had 12 rollovers in all of my classes. And one of them was on that hill where the guy just didn't remember left was left, and he wanted to turn right, and it turned him upside down in the ditch.
So do you happen to remember how many classes you taught along with how many students?
I can't give you numbers of students. I can't give you numbers of classes. What I can give you is what I used to use for bragging rights. And if you count all the people in the car covering the miles of a tour, if I were an airlines, I could brag about having put 15 million off-road miles, people miles, under my belt without a single injury. That's the way I put it, without an injury. You know, yeah, we'd end up with skin knuckles when you're trying to build a road and pick up rocks and, you know, slip a little on a walking tour and maybe bang your shins. But, 15 million passenger miles without injury.
So what is it like to launch a new? You mentioned launching. I believe you mentioned launching.
Yeah, a couple of them. It varied from kind of mundane to people not, in my opinion, not being able to follow instructions to the most exciting one I did was I helped Ford launch their 1991 Explorer, and the people they were doing this launch with were 200 Southern California disc jockeys. And you can just without much energy consider there's a lot of ego that goes with all disc jockeys. And I told them this is like a tour, and I want you to experience the vehicle, and it's not a race. Well, it became a race, and that was really tough to get control of. We had CB radios with all of them, and generally people are mic shy, not 200 disc jockeys. So there was lots of competing for airtime. And I didn't have a chance to, you know, offer all the information I'd want to offer because somebody else was already on the air. But it's exciting. That was actually kind of fun. It was at the Borrego Springs town area at the airport. And Ford had spent, I don't know, $100,000 building a Western village, a simulated ghost town, if you will. And we launched the tour from there and then returned back to there. And so that was quite a big deal and quite exciting and a lot of fun.
So what type of research does it take to write books about regional trails?
It primarily takes starting where many people don't want to start. I go to the land manager and I go to him and I say, hey, I'm going to do a book and I want to know your rules and I want to have your do's and don'ts for all your trails. I want you to tell me what you want me to put in, what you don't want me to put in, and so on. I won a contract from the state of California to map the entire state's off-highway vehicle system, regardless of land manager. That included the Forest Service, the BLM, certain cities and counties, the California Department of Parks and Recreation, everybody in the state of California that had has actually now still property where you can run a four-wheel drive. I had to map that and put it together in a form of a book. And first concern was with all those agencies, I was afraid there was going to be a lot of interagency competitiveness. It turned out there wasn't. And what I did was, is just like I said to start with, I just went out to the agency and I says, hey, what do you have? What do you want me to do? How do you want me to present it? And anyway, long story short, completed the book contract, made the book, and on time and on budget.
Nice.
So is that book still in publication, or has it been updated and taken over by
someone else? No, it's not. Actually, I took a loss on it. I say, on budget. Well, that meant money out of my pocket, because my original intent was, is I figured that I was going to get such a reputation for making this book that other states would be standing in line for me to do their state's book, and then I could turn it into more money. And it turned out that mostly due to the politics and so on of things, that never happened. They never did a second printing. They sold out the first printing like a couple of months after it came out. And then they never did a follow-on printing. And so that was disappointing. But no, it's not still in print.
What was the name of the book?
California OHV Guidebook, okay. I think. I'd have to go get a copy of it to see what
reporting
it
is. Them all.
And now, you know, with GPS, that was pre-GPS, because when I made – there's even a story behind winning that contract was I had come from aerospace, and I guess it's bragging, but I'd had some pretty significant responsibilities. I'd been marketing manager for the Hughes Aircraft Company semiconductor division, $60 million a year. I'd been responsible for a production operation that was shipping $4.7 million a year. So I kind of knew big business. So I made my proposal to the state to win this contract look like an aerospace proposal, you know, just cover bells and whistles and so on. My proposal, and since they weren't definitive enough as to exactly what they want, I made three proposals. My plain vanilla, my chocolate sundae, and my banana split versions is what I called them. And my proposals were so, they so outclassed the other people that bid. They disqualified all the rest of the bidders, and all the rest of the bidders were the in crowd, the local guys that were doing business up in Sacramento, the state capital, regularly, and they just knew they were going to get the contract. And they protested it because they say, well, you don't have any other bidders. And the state came back, Department of Parks and Rec came back and says, no, we have three bids. So my three bids, I'd competed against myself and won the contract.
So what were some of the challenges with leading off-road tours?
Keeping the people under control. Primarily, I had to establish that there was only one leader. And you get a cross section of people in these classes. You get people that were probably more capable and more capable vehicles than I. And then there's people that never been out before. You know, they were worried about getting their floorboards dusty. So you get quite a cross section of people. And I tend to lead the trips all wrong is what I would lecture in class. For the photographer, I'm driving way too fast and not making near enough stops. To the guy that just wants to drive, I'm making way too many stops and driving way too slow. So I lead them all wrong. So there would be people that would want to take over. And I would have to, and I wasn't in a mode to make friends. I was in a mode to take safety responsibility for the participants from a safety point of view. And, for example, I was leading that Copper Canyon trip once, and this attorney who was on the trip, we stopped one place, and I said, hey, you're going to have for gasoline. I said, hey, you're going to have to make it fast. You can buy or do whatever you want for lunch, but we got to be out of here in whatever it was, 15 minutes, far too short a time for lunch. And he came back after we'd finished the gasoline thing and had regrouped, and he says, Harry, we took a vote and we're going to stop for lunch. And I says, Frank, you only have one thing to vote on, whether you follow me or not. We're leaving now. And he caught on real quick. That was the guy in control. If you want to lead the tour, take the guys that want to follow you. And I told the people, I says, hey, you can choose to follow him. You can follow me, but I'm the guy leading the trip. We're leaving now. So as you can tell, that might not make friends, but I can, well, my 15 million miles of injury-free passenger miles is what that comes from, is taking control of things like that.
Don't forget to visit Patriot Patch and join the Patch of the Month Club. Consider our monthly pledge page to help support the Off-Road Podcast. Remember to use our Amazon affiliate link for all of your Amazon shopping needs. Also, check out Gaia affiliate link for up to 40% off. And don't forget to head over to Warn and check out their great winches, recovery gear, and armor.
And we are proud part of the Firearms Radio Network, firearmsradio.tv, your one-stop shop for your firearms radio entertainment. Please leave us some feedback at offroadpodcast@gmail.com. Also, leave us some comments on our iTunes, our webpage, or your podcatcher app to help promote the show. Full show notes available at firearmsradio.tv/the-off-road-podcast/whatever episode this is. And don't forget to visit our Facebook at facebook.com/offroadpodcast. Or our Instagram at Off-Road Podcast, or our YouTube. Jeremy's always releasing something, and always went off-road. Please remember to be smart, courteous, alert, safe, and always have fun, tread lightly, and thank you for listening.
And a production of the Firearms Radio. This has been a production of the Firearms Radio Network. You can find more information at firearmsradio.tv.
That was chaos. I'm going to hate myself.
You'll figure it out.
I'll figure it out.